Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. For several weeks, protesters and police have been battling for control over Hong Kong's streets. The demonstrations erupted after Hong Kong's government considered a controversial extradition bill to mainland China. Joining The Crisis Next Door to talk about the protest is Anthony Dapperan, a Hong Kong-based writer and lawyer and author of City of Protest, a recent history of dissent in Hong Kong. Anthony, thank you very much for joining us today on The Crisis Next Door.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about, before we get into the actual protest, the Fugitive Offenders and Mutual Legal Assistance in Criminal Matters Legislation Bill 2019. That is a mouthful. What exactly was that bill? What did it mean? And why did it spark these protests?
Yeah, sure. It sounds like a very technical legal matter, but it was in relation to a very practical problem. What happened was there was a young Hong Kong couple that went on vacation to Taiwan, and sadly they ended up in some kind of domestic dispute, and it's alleged that the male of the couple murdered the female while they were in Taiwan, and then he fled back to Hong Kong. And because under Hong Kong law, as it is currently written, you can only extradite someone out of Hong Kong to face a criminal trial in another jurisdiction if they're going to be sent to those countries with whom Hong Kong already has an extradition treaty. And there are only a limited number of them, and they are all the kind of, democratic nations that you would expect. One of the places that Hong Kong doesn't have a treaty with is Taiwan, and the other one is mainland China. And so the government proposed to sort of plug this loophole, ostensibly to address this murder case. But what they said they would do is change the law to remove that geographic restriction, so that if you wanted to extradite someone to face a criminal trial somewhere else, they could go to any country, provided that some basic boxes were ticked. And of course, that would have enabled this particular suspect to go to Taiwan to face trial. And this is where the controversy arose. It also would have meant that people could have been extradited from Hong Kong to face trial in mainland Chinese courts for crimes that the mainland authorities might have alleged they've committed. And that sparked a huge uproar in Hong Kong, simply because people in Hong Kong didn't feel they trusted the mainland Chinese judicial system. Since the handover from the UK to China in 1997, Hong Kong's been ruled under one country, two systems. So it's had its own separate legal system, its own court system. It's been entirely separate from the rest of China, and Hong Kong people didn't want to see, not want to see that change, but didn't want to see any kind of risk that would blur the distinction between the two and could see someone end up being sent from Hong Kong to face trial in a mainland court. And that's what started the whole controversy.
Are there fears in Hong Kong that one country, two systems could turn into one country, one system, and this bill would simply be a start of that move?
Yeah, I think that's precisely the fear. Under the basic law, which is Hong Kong's constitution after the handover, this one country, two systems formula is promised to stay in place for the first 50 years. That's until 2047. And that's a minimum, not a maximum, by the way. So it's an open question what will happen after that. But people were precisely concerned that through this and perhaps other gradual chipping away at their rights and freedoms, that Hong Kong would be reaching that point much earlier than 2047. I think that's what sparked the very large reaction that we saw here on the streets of Hong Kong.
These protests have been going on for several weeks. The violence seems to be increasing. What do the protesters want from Hong Kong and also possibly from Beijing here?
Initially, the demand was just to withdraw this proposed extradition bill. But as the weeks have gone on and the protests have gone on, the protest demands have developed and changed, partly in response to the government's reaction and partly in response to things that have happened in the course of the protests. But also, I think they've just broadened to sort of take in other matters of discontent for the population. So initially the protests were subject to some very harsh policing, and there have been a lot of controversy around the way the police have handled the protests. So the protesters' demands expanded to include not only withdrawing the extradition bill, but also having an independent commission of inquiry into the way the police have handled the protests. And then some specific demands around the way people arrested during the protests are treated and charged and those sorts of things. But now, even more than that, they are starting to talk about wanting more democracy and wanting universal suffrage in Hong Kong. These were things that were demanded, you might recall, back in the Umbrella Movement protests of 2014, another large protest movement that we saw here in Hong Kong, which at the time ended in failure. The protesters back then wanted universal suffrage to elect the chief executive, who's sort of effectively the governor, the head of the Hong Kong government. They didn't get that. And now, as this protest has dragged on, they're starting to ask for that as well. And so, the government, one of the key problems is the government hasn't really addressed any of their demands. And so as things unwind and events occur, those demands sort of are beginning to snowball to a point where it's going to become, I think, quite difficult for the government to do anything to address everything that people are asking for, I think, at this point.
We certainly should not be surprised by the protest, especially given in your book, City of Protest, A Recent History of Dissent in Hong Kong. Should we be surprised by how the police have cracked down on the protesters with the tear gas, the rubber bullets?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should. The protests are generally peaceful. Now, look, that said, I think there are some extreme protesters who do try to provoke confrontations with the police. But what we've sort of unfortunately got into with these protests is a little bit of a cycle of violence where the police, I think, were fairly heavy-handed to begin with. They now seem to be resorting to tear gas as a first step rather than as sort of an extreme measure. Because the police are ramping up their level of force, the protesters themselves get better prepared. They gear up with shields and building barricades and then have started to, I guess, use some sort of offensive items as well. In order to prepare themselves to face the violence from the police. The police then see that and see that as a justification to use greater force themselves, and you end up with this kind of spiraling increased level of violence. And every week, frankly, it gets a little bit violent on both sides. So we've gone from tear gas and pepper pellets to rubber bullets to sponge grenades. And I think everyone is widely expecting that in the next few weeks, we're going to see the debut on Hong Kong streets for the first time of some shiny new water cannon vehicles that the Hong Kong police force have purchased. So it just keeps ratcheting up and up. And my concern is that in this kind of cycle, unless someone does something, and that presumably would be the government, but they're not really doing anything. Unless someone does something to break this cycle, I'm really concerned it's going to end up probably with someone accidentally getting killed. I don't think it's going to happen deliberately, but once you have this level of violence in the streets week after week, it's only a matter of time before someone gets accidentally shot in the head with a rubber bullet or hit with a truncheon or knocked onto the ground and bangs their head on the sidewalk or whatever, and there's going to be a fatality on one side or the other. And I think that really is going to be obviously a tragedy, and I think at this stage still a preventable one.
Anthony, you've been very active on Twitter following the events in Hong Kong, and you've listed that police are hated but not feared. Can you explain the significance of what that means for the protest movement?
Yeah, and I'm looking at that from sort of, I guess, the slightly longer history of the Hong Kong police, who were, once regarded as Asia's finest, and were seen as a reasonably benevolent and benign police force. There wasn't anywhere near, the degree of hatred of the police that we see even in some Western countries, frankly. The police were generally seen as the good guys. But in the course of both the umbrella movement, a subsequent protest that we had called the Fishbowl Revolution, the Fishbowl Riots, rather, in Mong Kok a couple of years ago, and then in particular in the course of these protests, there have been a lot of conflicts between ordinary civilians and police, and a lot of violent actions taken by police that people are unhappy about, and there's a sense that the police are not accountable. An incident that occurred recently that got people extremely agitated and unhappy was a few weeks ago, protesters returning from the protest to one of the suburban train stations were attacked by mobs wielding bamboo canes and poles who were pro-Beijing, anti-protester gangs said to be allied with or somehow connected with the triad organized crime gangs. And police were very slow to respond to that incident. There's footage of a couple of police sort of turning up, seeing what was happening and then turning and running away again. They say because they didn't have sufficient manpower to deal with the problem. But these attacks went on for, almost an hour before the police turned up. And then there's also footage of the police, standing and chatting with, guys holding clubs basically in the street and not doing anything about it. So there was a very strong reaction to this from the public and from the protesters in particular, that the police are effectively colluding with the triads in this attack. And so that and other incidents have led to a really high degree of animosity from the community directed towards the police. And so the point I was trying to make was that, the Hong Kong police are in a process of transitioning from being a kind of, benevolent community-based police force that we might be used to seeing in a Western democracy, towards being the kind of police force that operates under an authoritarian dictatorship, where the police are, the enforcers for the government. And the characteristic of that kind of police force is that it's hated and feared. People hate those kind of police forces, and they're also afraid of them, and so they obey. But the problem that the Hong Kong police have at the moment is they're only halfway there, so they're currently reaching a point where they're hated and getting a lot of abuse from protesters at the front lines, but people aren't yet scared of them, and perhaps that's alluding precisely to the point I was making earlier, because they're not worried that they're going to get killed. So I think, I should say by way of background for perhaps your US listeners and other listeners in other countries, there's very, very little gun violence in Hong Kong. Civilians are not allowed to own guns. And so police officers very rarely are called upon to use their firearms in their day-to-day policing. In fact, I think the last I checked, I think there was one firearm homicide in Hong Kong in the last 5 years or something like that. People aren't that afraid. So they're happy to shout obscenities at police and give them the finger rile them up, thinking that, they're not going to suffer for that. So I think what, is going to happen is, because obviously this situation can't go on. You can't have a community disrespecting its police force in this way, partly as just a matter of running the society, but also because I think the police can't stand that level of abuse for so long. So I think the abuse is going to have to stop. And there's one of two ways of doing it. Either the police, tone it down a bit and win back the trust of the community, or the other way they could do it is go all the way and start to behave in a way that gets people to be genuinely afraid of them and stopping this kind of behavior. And I'm worried that that's the direction we're heading.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the growing protests in Hong Kong over an extradition bill to mainland China with Anthony Dapperan, a Hong Kong-based writer and lawyer and author of City of Protest, A Recent History of Dissent in Hong Kong. China has said that it prefers a political solution over a military solution and firmly supports Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam. Does this seem encouraging that this could still be determined locally in Hong Kong, or do you think Beijing is just waiting for the moment where it can decide what needs to be done?
I do take that at its face value, at least in terms of, the implication that, Beijing would directly intervene, for example, by bringing the People's Liberation Army out onto the street, something like that. I don't think that's likely, and I do take the statement at face value that I do think Beijing wants the Hong Kong government and the Hong Kong police force to resolve this on their own. But I guess that the other slight subtlety to your question is that I also think that Beijing is operating behind the scenes very much. And I'm sure that, you know, senior Beijing officials are talking to Hong Kong senior government officials about how they should resolve things and the things that they'd like to see. So, you know, I'm sure that Beijing and you know, so I'm sure this is no surprise, and, you know, that Beijing, you know, would be involved in some way, but they don't want to intervene directly, you know, and certainly I don't think we're going to reach the point where we see them doing something like bringing the PLA out to the streets unless things get very, very significantly worse. And I think we're a long way from that yet. So, I think they're going to choose to continue operating through the mechanisms that they have on the ground here in Hong Kong.
Are there any fears from people in Hong Kong of the PLA making a move? And what kind of PLA presence is there in Hong Kong as far as barracks, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so there's certainly a sizable garrison in Hong Kong of PLA soldiers. They have a number of barracks, one right in the middle of Hong Kong Island, right on the waterfront, a very large building, which is their headquarters, then a number of barracks situated in the suburbs. I understand there may be something between 5,000 to 10,000 PLA troops in Hong Kong at any given time, but they never emerge from their barracks. So there's been an unspoken policy that they do not operate out. They don't exit their barracks in uniform. So they're restricted to barracks in terms of, you know, wearing their uniform and those sorts of things. If they leave the barracks for whatever reason, it's sort of in a civilian capacity. And that has been the case for the 22 years since the handover. Now, is there any anxiety that might change? Yeah, it's always bubbling below the surface to a certain extent. And of course, in the last couple of months, that question's been asked very directly. And, you know, possibly for political purposes, we're seeing in the media here certain pro-Beijing figures openly speculating about it. Whether that's, you know, as a tactic to inspire some fear and try and tamp down the protests, or whether they, you know, just sort of voicing their own personal preference that they'd quite like the PLA to get out into the streets or whatever it may be, or whether it's a little bit of kite flying by Beijing, it's not too clear. But I think people also recognize, and I think Beijing also recognizes too, that the optics of that would be terrible, and the impact that would have on Hong Kong's reputation as an international finance center, as a place where foreign businesses felt comfortable to do business and locate their senior executives from around the world together with their families, you know, would be possibly irreparably harmed by a deployment of the PLA on the streets, and I think that. That calculus, i.e. what's worse for Hong Kong's reputations, the protesters or the PLA, is still very much the case that the PLA would be the worst, have the worst impact on Hong Kong's reputation. And I think we have to see the protest side of that balance, that equation, to get significantly worse before that calculus will change.
Now, mentioning optics, it's been 30 years since Tiananmen Square. Do you think that crackdown is in the back of Xi Jinping's mind?
Yeah, I think that is has been an undercurrent to Chinese politics and to the Hong Kong issue and to really the way the world sees China ever since it occurred. It's something that, you know, in a way, you know, China has never been entirely able to live down. But also, it's something that I think at the same time, if you asked, you know, senior Beijing government leaders today, I think many would still argue that that was the correct decision because it prevented a wider protest movement that could well have toppled the government at the time. So it's a very complex historical issue that definitely continues to have resonances all the way down to the present day in China and certainly for Hong Kong as well, yes.
Adam Yu is a China security analyst with Macquarie University in Sydney, and he told the Washington Post that China has no short-term answers to the impasse. Hardline will backfire. Conciliatory will be interpreted by protesters that Beijing is weakened and that they will demand more. Do you think that's an accurate assessment? And if that is the case, where does that leave Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think it is probably a fair assessment, and that's exactly the problem we find ourselves in. And that's how Hong Kong has sort of been muddling along, at least for the last 5 years. As I mentioned, the umbrella movement protests of 2014 earlier, the key issue there was that Hong Kong has wanted more democracy, and I think that issue hasn't really gone away, and that's still what's driving the protests today. And now Beijing find themselves, you know, a little bit stuck, exactly in the way that Adam describes, in the sense that, you know, certainly a harsh crackdown on the protesters would do incredible damage to Hong Kong's reputation, probably economy, and possibly to, you know, more broadly to China's economy as well. But at the same time, you know, having a significant relaxation will, you know, on the one hand, send a message to protesters that Beijing is willing to back down, but also I think Beijing's worried about, you know, contagion to the mainland, obviously. And they're just worried that, you know, any loosening of control on the fringes of the empire will be a problem for Beijing. And so we do get stuck in this sort of cycle of repression and protest and repression and protest. I think my best guess at the moment is what Beijing is hoping to do is to damp down the current wave of protests with some very heavy-handed policing, or as they'd like to put it, you know, strict enforcement of the law. I think we will see that water cannon come out. We will see the police probably move from a tactic of dispersal of protesters to a tactic of containment and arrest. I think we'll probably likely see mass arrests of sort of hundreds of protesters in the coming weeks until, you know, either there are no protesters left to arrest or that so many of them are deterred by this that they stop coming out. And then I think that Beijing will then move into, once they've sort of got things under control from a law and order point of view, move into something of a charm offensive. And we saw this in a press conference that Chinese officials gave on Monday afternoon, the first time actually that the senior officials responsible for Hong Kong had come out and given this kind of press conference, in which, yes, they did talk about the need to maintain law and order, but they also recognized underlying economic issues and social tensions in Hong Kong. And so I think that once they damp down the current round of protests, however that happens, they're going to try and target some of those standard of living, you know, housing affordability, economic issues, and hope that by improving those, they're going to reduce the social discontent in Hong Kong. So I guess that leaves really two big question marks. Firstly, are they going to be successful in stopping these protests? I mean, they've been going on a long time. They've got a lot of energy behind them and no signs yet that they're going to die down. And there's always the risk that harsher policing will just prompt more people to come out or prompt greater protesters. So that's the first question. And then the second question is, will improving the economy really make people happy? I mean, we've now seen these protesters talking about the democratic issues that they're interested in, and it could well be that that's what they really care about, and a good economy or cheaper housing is not going to satisfy them. They want the democracy that they're talking about on the streets. So I can see the strategy that Beijing probably has in mind, but there's still some big question marks as to whether that's going to work to calm things down in Hong Kong and get things back to business as usual.
Anthony, you mentioned the word contagion. Any word as to whether the rest of China is aware of what's going on in Hong Kong or how state media is portraying the events to mainland China?
Yes, well, as I'm sure you've heard, mainland China maintains extremely tight control of information flows going into China, and their censorship and control of the internet there is near absolute. So for the first several weeks of these protests, there was, you know, almost zero news of them getting into the mainland. And that really changed only over the last week or so, where it seemed that the officials in Beijing decided that they were going to open the taps. But of course, do that in a very tightly controlled way. And the way that they did that was to show news of these violent protests and then to weave a narrative around how these protests have been entirely fomented by foreign governments and foreign agents. And this is all a foreign-inspired plot to try and turn Hong Kong into a problem for China, and to undermine China as a whole, undermine the Chinese government, and undermine China's position in the world. And that's been played extremely hard on the state media in the mainland over the past week or two. And that seems to be the way that they're framing it. And any news that does leak out, or not leak out, or any news that is placed into the mainland media at the moment is sticking with that narrative. And so I think that's the aim is very much to avoid any kind of contagion in the mainland or any kind of indication that this is any kind of a people's power movement, and certainly to avoid inspiring other people on the mainland to get similar ideas.
How are Hong Kong's non-protesters taking this? Annoyance? Sympathy?
Look, certainly for the anti-extradition bill, there was, I would say, almost universal support for the protesters. No one wanted, liked, or supported that proposal. As the protests have gone on and morphed into different aims, I would say there is still generally broad support. There are certainly some elements of the community that are more more favour, I guess the prosperity and stability narrative that you might say that and that anything that goes on this long, regardless of how laudable the cause may be, is now reaching a point where it's undermining Hong Kong's prosperity and stability. But I would say there is still pretty broad support for the protesters overall. For example, just yesterday, protesters were undertook a civil disobedience action to shut down the subway system, basically. They were blocking the doors of the subway trains to prevent the trains from departing, pulling the emergency stop brakes, and basically brought at least one line of the subway system to a standstill for an hour or two during the morning rush hour. And reports from people on the ground, at the train platforms and in the trains, were that the crowds there, you would expect, pretty angry commuters, but the crowds were fairly sanguine about it. And indeed, when the civil disobedience action concluded as the protesters were leaving, they were even applauded by the crowds waiting on the platforms who sort of chanted slogans in support of them. They certainly weren't, there wasn't any footage emerging of angry commuters sort of berating protesters on the train. So that's maybe one indication of how people are feeling more generally.
It's going to be very interesting to see how this develops and where the protests lead in Hong Kong. Anthony, stay safe and thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thanks for speaking to me. It's a pleasure.
We've been talking with Anthony Dapiran, a Hong Kong-based writer and lawyer and author of City of Protest, A Recent History of Dissent in Hong Kong. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.